Hi, welcome to Backstage Soundtrack. I'm Tom from Hot Tub Time Machine. This week, I'm chatting to Nathan Cavalieri. Nathan is known to most Australians as the guitar prodigy who achieved phenomenal success at a ridiculously young age by shredding the blues on TV while also battling leukemia. Look out, kids, here she comes, superhuman. His life story is incredible, and I totally recommend you watch ABC TV's Australian Story documentary about him. I'll put the link in the episode notes, which you can find by swiping up if you're on an iPhone. It's great. Check it out. He's been through an incredible amount, but seems to have found stability and happiness in recent times by playing and singing his own original blues, folk, rock music. And since COVID hit, streaming on Twitch, which is where we met. His Twitch streams are on a different level to anyone else on the platform, just because of the sheer musical talent that he has, but also what an open-hearted, funny, and humble person he is to hang out with. In this interview, we chat about the blues, rock and roll, hip-hop, what makes a musical prodigy, and the time he dissed hip-hop to Dr. Dre on the Arsenio Hall show. Classic Nathan Cavalieri stuff. We listen to a heap of great music. As always, there's a Spotify playlist with all the songs in the episode description. We recorded this over Zoom in October 2021 while I was in quarantine in Adelaide and Nathan at his home in Sydney. I kicked it off by asking what he listens to while commuting to his studio.
I'm listening to a podcast on that drive, yeah. And every now and then, if I really feel like I need to listen to some music, it'll generally be something, you know, that brings me home, like not necessarily something new, but something that just triggers some good memories. Like, say, for example, my mood just completely shifts when I listen to Creedence Clearwater Bad Moon Rising.
Man.
You know.
I'm going to put that on right now. So good. Is this the kind of, was your dad into this, into Creedence?
No. And that's the thing. I didn't really get into Creedence Clearwater until much later in life. And I think it was the Creedence Clearwater song I had heard was Green River. And
which one's Green River? I'm going to look it up.
Actually, you know who it was? It was from Creedence Clearwater came to me via Don Walker, because I had just started singing at the time that I was co-writing with Don Walker.
Just to clarify, is Don Walker, is he the songwriter guy from Chisel?
Cold Chisel.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, piano player and songwriter of Cold Chisel and a lot of other amazing artists. And so, yeah, I was really lucky to be collaborating with him when I was like, you know, 14, 15 years old. But it was also at a time where I was trying to find my voice. And at the time I was kind of singing, you know, down low and really insecure, you know. And we wrote this song called Nowhere to Run, which never ended up being released. Mm-hmm. And you know, we wrote it sort of mid-register. And then he said, why don't you bump it up an octave? And I'm like, I can't hit those notes. And he said, just do it. Just yell it out. Don't worry. Don't overthink it. And so he helped me find my high register, you know, and he said, you've got a John Fogerty vibe, like up there. And he said, start singing some John Fogerty, start singing some Creedence Clearwater. I'm like, I don't really know much Creedence Clearwater. And he said, well, and so Green River and...
I got to play this one. This was...
Yeah, Grapevine. Their version of Grapevine. I loved it. Yeah.
My dad had this LP at home.
Yeah.
It's the one, iconic one with a cover. And this song, I just listened to endlessly.
And that clap on the snare. So, you know, and the first time I heard that song was Creedence, not Marvin Gaye.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man. So what kind of blues was your dad into? Like, I like to get into a little bit of life story. Obviously, your life story is so out there, we won't go into it too much. But
no,
I like hearing what kind of music you're into when you're a kid and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well... blues was really big in the house.
So it's like kind of real purist blues, for want of a better term, or what kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't Robert Johnson. It wasn't okay. That old sort of, you know, his favorite blues, which ended up being mine, was Freddie King and B.B. King and Stevie Ray Vaughan.
What's a song of that genre that we can check out?
So I'd probably say the earliest song that I can remember that I heard blues was an instrumental by Freddie King called The Stumble.
Let's check it out. The Stumble.
And it just makes you smile.
This one?
No, that's the live version. That's the live version, wrong version. Okay.
Oh, The Stumble. Here we go.
Here we go. You know, it wasn't your typical 12-bar blues either.
What makes it not typical 12-bar blues? Is it like some different changes and stuff?
I think it's an 8-bar blues, I could be wrong, but there's just some of those extra changes there instead of, you know, 1-4, you know, 1, back to the 5 and around we go. So, but also that melody, for me, that melody was just so catchy. So you can imagine as a 6-year-old, it almost has a real kiddie type melody. You know,
the melody on the guitar.
Yeah.
See, that's kind of interesting to me because it's like, it's not a melody like, you know, when I was that age, I was listening to freaking Billie Jean or something where you listen to the melody of the vocals, but you're hearing the melody in the guitar.
Yeah, so, and that forms the fundamentals of how I play guitar because a lot of the blues musicians I grew up listening to were so melodic. I mean, even outside of the blues, like you know, Mark Knopfler, Dire Straits, it's all about the melody. And my dad, as my teacher of guitar, was always preaching, tell a story, don't just wail, you know, and I love a good wail. And I think that was also the struggle for him is that he was bringing up a kid in the 80s, you know, at a time when it was all like Steve Vai and Joe Satriani and,
right,
and Van Halen and everything. So I did have this natural, you know, I was naturally drawn to that kind of shredding, you know, thing, but, and he kind of pulled me back a little bit, but I just
had a thought there and it just occurred to me that I remember, my dad was obsessed with the Beatles and, we remember listening to While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which we were going to do together. And I remember he had we were listening to the solo again and again. And dad was like, this is Eric Clapton, you know, one of the greatest guitar. And I was like, I remember saying to him, well, it doesn't sound that difficult. Doesn't sound that hard. He's like, that's not what it's all about, man.
What it's about? No. And my dad's philosophy, even when I was playing up on stage, was that you don't have to be a guitarist to feel the emotion, you know, of a guitar player on stage. And he's dead right with that one. And then there was Stevie Ray Vaughan. Now, right. when I heard Stevie Ray Vaughan, so now you've just heard Freddie King's The Stumble, which was from the 60s or early 70s, I can't quite remember. And now you go into what is hi-fi production of Stevie Ray Vaughan. And the first time I heard Stevie Ray Vaughan was a song called, I think it was called, I can't remember the exact order, but all right, let's play. So Cold Shot.
Cold Shot.
That was his big hit. And that was just that Texas shuffle, you know, and all of a sudden hi-fi production.
Yeah, it's got that real clean 80s kind of drums, doesn't it?
Totally.
I don't know much about Stevie Ray Vaughan. I know he's like a deity amongst like guitar and blues people.
Now, this was just his really the most accessible song he's done that was plastered all over radio. And then the album itself, as a kid, I was drawn to the wilder songs on Stevie Ray Vaughan's album. So Scuttle Button is the one that you want to play. And that's, when you listen to that, then you go, ah, oh, all right, that's what blew people's faces off.
In terms of the, like, virtuosity.
Yeah. As an 8-year-old, this spoke to me. No, spoke to my heart and my hormones. I was just chatting, what is this?
Nath, do you have an opinion on whether people are born with a musical gene or not?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I reckon.
I often have a debate. See, I wonder whether some people are just born to be slightly obsessive and to be really into something. And maybe if your dad was really into basketball, you would have been a basketballer.
Yeah, maybe. But hey, but my kids here, they tell me to shut up. They do not want to hear music. They don't want to, like, I'm trying to play music around the house. I can't even pick up a guitar without them saying, no songs, daddy, no. It's annoying. There's too much noise. And my brother didn't take to music like I did. Having said that, they reflect on me as not being a natural at it, though. I had this right from, you know, 3 years old, just this, like, you know, just I was so attracted to it. It just did something to me, and I had to play guitar, but they said I was not good at it. Like they said the thing that was natural was your passion to play.
Yes.
Not your ability, but your work ethic.
Yes.
You had really good work ethic. So I just buried myself in my room and played, and then mixed that with my dad, you know, being an old school Italian, discipline and all that type of stuff. You know, it was just the equation, I suppose.
I do kind of, I guess people who are described as prodigies or something, it often diminishes the sheer amount of work it takes to get to that skill. Like yeah. People will go, oh, he was born being that gifted or whatever. I think it's born to work that hard.
Totally, totally. Occasionally I do come past somebody that has just got an amazing voice or whatever, sure, and they've just haven't really put the time in. I don't want to, you know, Vanessa Amorosi and I have been friends for a long time, although we've been out of touch for a while since she moved to the States, but she didn't know who Aretha Franklin was, you know, or any of those, like, it was just, she just sang. Like she struck me as somebody who didn't really spend hours on end,
sure,
you know, working it. So possibly a virtuoso there, but yeah,
it's interesting, man. Do you remember getting into any music that was kind of almost a rebellion against what your dad liked and that early blues stuff? What was those kind of songs?
Yeah, very much so. I would say Diesel probably be a bit pissed off thinking that it was a rebellion to listen to him. But I remember the first vinyl I ever bought was not blues, right? Actually, hang on, let me rewind a bit.
Sure.
The first vinyl I ever played was my mum's. Like, she gave me one of those single turntable things, right? And gave me a whole bunch of her singles. And the first single I played, and I just could not stop playing it, was Slade.
Slade.
Come Feel the Noise. And they spelt it with a U-M, which I didn't realize what that meant until much later. But Come Feel the Noise, Slade. Baby, baby. Yeah.
'73. The cover is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Just describe it for people on the podcast. They're like in kind of a four formation, like a Bohemian Rhapsody kind of thing, wearing scarves, and it's worth watching. It's kind of early glam rock. Is that right? Would that be accurate?
I suppose you could call it that. Yeah. And I played the shit out of that that record. So I think that was the first time I heard rock.
Sure.
You know, that wasn't Money for Nothing, you know, Dire Straits type stuff. So Slade. And then the first vinyl I ever bought was The Injectors, Johnny Diesel and The Injectors. And the first song I heard off that was the first song on the album, which was Looking for Love. So I really fell in love with rock, probably because of Diesel and then a lot of other, yeah.
It's interesting that there's such separation for you between blues and rock. Like, blues seems like a genre where there's a real, it's almost like a straitjacket. Like in hip hop, keeping it real can be a straitjacket for some artists and stuff. And blues seems a bit like that.
Yeah. But which is why later in life I kind of departed, because blues only said so much. Like I had so much I wanted to say and express that traditional blues didn't allow. Probably my second album, when I was signed to Michael Jackson's label, you could start to hear how I was crossing over into you know, incorporating other styles. So Diesel, then definitely, I know my dad didn't like Nirvana and Soundgarden and you know, Friends Will Rom, and that was probably the, you know, I didn't listen to it to pee him off, but
it was your music though. Were you a Triple J kid? Were you, is that where you found this stuff? Or
no, Triple M. It was the Rubber Room.
Sweet.
Remember the Rubber Room? What was your name?
Yeah. I was a Triple J guy, man. It was all I listened to.
Were we the same age?
Yeah, pretty much. I think I'm 42.
Right. Yeah, no, I remember just, yeah, late night Triple M. I think the first time I heard something out of that era was actually Black Hole Sun.
Oh my God, that's such a good song.
To me, is one of my favorite songs ever.
I think so. I totally agree, man. I've tried to play it at a couple of gigs, like at giant festivals, just rocking out Black Hole Sun. It's a tough sell.
Yeah,
it's so
yeah.
self-indulgent to play because I love it so much, but...
In my eyes, in what a voice. Sound,
also,
yeah.
Just that arpeggio, is it, on the dung dung?
Yeah, through the Leslie.
So through like a spinning Leslie cabinet thing, do you reckon?
Yeah. When that chorus kicks in with those just huge guitars, I remember hearing it just going, whoa. And...
Well, huge guitars, huge drums. I'm all about the drums here when he does the classic Tom fill. Here he goes. Black hole sun, won't you come? Huge. Huge.
You know what's interesting? Do you class this as grunge? Do you class Soundgarden as a grunge band?
Sure. Yeah.
It's funny. I put Nirvana there. I put Pearl Jam there. Stone Temple Pilots.
Right.
There's something about Soundgarden for me that makes them not your stereotypical grunge. And I know... heaps. I mean, that song, grunge, right? When I listen to Pretty Noose and, you know, just, I don't know. There's it's like there's too much
production?
Intricacy and thought and to keep it in, you know, stereotypically in the world of grunge. Well, I was having this debate on stream. And it was a real divide with people that go, nah, fuck you, man. They're grunge, you know. They're pretty much the center of grunge.
This is a Soundgarden song I know we both love. I think we've spoken about this one before.
Oh, yeah. Kind of mandolin, I think, or...
I love how your ear could just pick up on these things, on, like, tones and shit. See, like, to me, grunge, like, obviously, we all know that... genre labels are nonsense, but it's like, yeah, there was a rawness to that early grunge of Nirvana that kind of tore apart the 80s rock and tore apart that whole glam and returned rock to its roots and stuff. But it was actually this more intricate 90s shit that I was into at the time, the Faith No More's, the Soundgardens and stuff, the stuff that was a bit more nerdy. And
well, that's I learned how to play drums. Because I actually had a lot of shame about being the guitarist that I was at school, so I just wanted to blend in, but I wanted to play music, and I liked, you know, rock and grunge and stuff like that. So that's when I dived further into playing drums. So, you know, the stuff I was playing drums to was Digging the Grave and Gentle Art of Making Enemies and yeah. and
I don't think it's aged particularly well. Like I was huge into Faith No More. Actually, I actually appeared on the J Files, Triple J, like Faith No More, as like a hardcore Faith No More fan. Basically, I talked my way into the studio just so that, because I wanted to work with Triple J and shit. And so I sent like Costa Zulio a message saying, I'm a huge Faith No More fan. Can I come in? And he let me come in. And I was so impressed that you could smoke in the studio. So there was like a 17-year-old smoking like a Dunny Blue in the studio at Triple J. But like I don't listen to Faith No More anymore. I had some friends who were going to the tour. To take it back to the grunge thing, that more, it hasn't aged as well as that bare bones rock and roll that like is timeless, you know?
Yeah, no, I do know what you mean there. I mean, having said that, I did go to see them when they played at Soundwave. Damn, what a festival. They talk about bad organization. They ran out of water at 1 p.m. It was 43 degrees.
That's awful.
Out there. It was the only thing they were selling was Jack and Coke cans.
Oh my God.
So I was so fucking sloshed, but I had the greatest time. I was listening to Faith No More came on after Jane's Addiction.
What year would that have been at Soundwave? Like
2000 and I was about 2011, I think,
okay.
10 or 11. And I've never played air anything in my life, but I was air drumming and air playing guitar to Faith No More. And
shit, yeah.
It was so good. And they destroyed it. They were amazing. All respect to Jane's Addiction. They just annihilated them. Like,
all right, we have to play Faith No More song now. Now, which one do you want? You said a couple
depends
earlier.
Depends how accessible you want to be, but you could probably, my two were either Gentle Art of Making Enemies or Digging the Grave.
Digging the Grave's really good. That was off
King for a Day.
King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime, which was, I loved that album.
Yeah.
Evidence was the best. The actual title song, King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime, I loved so much. Isn't that what it's about? I love, you know, this is the same band though that did like a Lionel Richie cover of Easy that was a massive hit.
Yeah,
like,
they're
I think I love that, but they were so weird and random.
I got into Mr. Bungle pretty hard as well.
Same. Same.
Yeah. Pretty trippy stuff.
Mr. Bungle, for those, look, we are going to go down Mr. Bungle Avenue here.
This you squeeze is, me macaroni.
Squeeze me macaroni. Let's do it. So this is the lead singer of Faith No More, Mike Patton, had a passion project, and a guitar player, Trey Spurance as well, was in this band called Mr. Bungle. And it was really weird shit. And yeah, little 90s music nerds were right into this shit, weren't we?
Totally. But again, I didn't get into them until later. We used to cover Squeeze Me Macaroni in this punk rock band that I was in. Talk about a mouthful.
Did you used to sing this?
Yeah, terribly though. Like, you know, terribly.
Totally.
That was always the thing in high school, is that you know, you might have a drummer and two guitar players and whoever the best one, well, whoever the worst guitar player was would end up playing the bass.
Yeah.
And you're always screwed for a vocalist. Well, I was at a boys' school but I think Faith No More is something you could get away with screaming out at the top of your lungs. You didn't really have to be and same with Rage Against the Machine. I mean, Rage Against the Machine for me was just, there was something a little bit bluesy about some of their riffs.
Yeah, definitely. The swing, the swagger, the ding, it's just all.
Yeah. And probably the obvious one, you know, Killing in the Name of, but when I really got into Renegades, their album Renegades, really hard. And I loved the production on that. Rich Costey was involved in that, who did Muse, and their version of How I Could Just Kill a Man,
right?
The Cypress Hill song is just insane. I mean, the bass in that was just.
Let's check that out. I haven't heard that at all.
Ever heard it?
I was kind of after Evil Empire with Rage Against the Machine. I was just kind of done. I'd had enough.
So mad. Do a stand.
Were you into hip hop?
I've touched on it here and there. My embarrassing hip hop story is I was on a talk show in America when I was 12 called Arsenio Hall.
Your life,
and,
man.
And so I didn't know anything about hip hop, and whenever I heard it, I didn't really like it. But my parents really hated it. I mean, sure. If there was any style that they didn't like, it was hip hop, because it's different now, but they just couldn't understand. It's like they're just talking. Like, it's, yeah. you know, that was their mentality, and that kind of rubbed off on me a little bit. But when I was in America, a lot of the kids that I was hanging out with, it was all about, you know, it was hip hop. So I'm on Arsenio Hall, and
the most hip hop talk show ever.
Yeah, and so I'm. After I've done my feature there, I'm sitting in with the band, and each time we go to the break, I just, you know, just wail away, right? So Dr. Dre is having an interview, and he gestures to me, and he's like, I love this kid, you know, and how awesome is this kid? And Arsenio Hall, he goes, Nathan, you know, do you like rap? And I'm like, not as much as blues. But I didn't mean it to be like an asshole. It was,
sure. You're just being honest.
Yeah, I was, any 12-year-old would just tell it how it is. And I got booed. And then, to this day, when I reflect on that, I can't believe I said that to, you know, the man of hip hop, Dre. Like, what the hell? I didn't even know who he was. Like, until
I think he's gonna like respect it though. You know, you're a blues kid.
Yeah. Well, that's where rap came from, hip hop came from. So I think it wasn't until my, you know, the later part of high school when rock started, you know, melting with hip hop, and that I really started to dig it. So totally. and still to this day, I really enjoy good hip hop. I'm not somebody who goes down those crazy rabbit holes, but even the production that I, you know, take on today for my own stuff, I find myself subconsciously being influenced by hip hop in a really big way. Like I love Mos Def, love Mos Def's productions, Jay-Z.
What song? The
one album that's not on Spotify.
Oh, right.
You have to check it out on YouTube because, it's called Quiet Dog. Quiet Dog, Mos Def. And it's so simple, and it's got some of those tribal influences. Yeah, so Mos Def, Talib Kweli, Jay-Z, of course.
Sure.
I love good banging hip hop.
Let's talk a little bit about songwriting, Nathan. Who are songwriters that you admire? Are there and songs that you listen to that because you it seems to me you kind of go between you know, pop and blues and all those kind of different styles of songwriting.
I take it all on. It depends what I'm looking for. I think and on the period. So when I first started songwriting, I was actually drawing a lot from and when I say songwriting, I mean more sort of getting into lyrics and melody and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It was back to Soundgarden. Soundgarden for me, I just love how poetic he was. And this was also before I really cared too much about the message.
Right.
Like I can't really understand you know, what the point of some of those Soundgarden songs are. It's like, it's beautiful words and, but I don't quite understand it. And maybe you're not supposed to understand it.
Or maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And maybe it doesn't matter. That's right. Yeah. So I would literally, when I'm songwriting, I would kind of do this exercise. Nobody taught me. I just kind of did this where I would do my version of Black Hole Sun. Like literally take the verse and go, all right, these are the types of the lyrics. All right, so what's my version of that?
Yeah.
And I try to channel that, you know, those poetic colors and melodies. And so
I think that's really common in all types of art and in music and songwriting stuff. Take something you like, and like I sort of know my wife who paints, like for would sit there a long time. Look, she spends all her time looking at like art books of artists she likes and just looking through their paintings yeah. And then like
yeah.
using that as a starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. Later in life, it became the story and the message became really important.
Right.
The melody, like good, simple melodies that translate with a good message. And for me, that gave me a new appreciation for bands like Cold Chisel. You know, those lyrics, those melodies, those really storytelling.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's some songs that off the top of your head that have good stories?
I mean, obvious ones, like say with Cold Chisel, like Flame Trees, beautiful song.
I was hoping you'd say Flame Trees. To me, it's like one of the greatest Australian songs ever written, if not, you know, I think probably You're the Voice might be number one, but like this is... Although You're the Voice was written by an English guy or something, wasn't it? I think it got given to John Farnham. But this song. Kids are driving Saturday afternoon, just passing. I love the accents on the verse too, the way it's actually quite hip hop, the way he kind of hits the syllables on
when
like
you say
the,
that like that, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. Any others off the top of your head that are good stories?
Yeah, from Cold Chisel, you mean?
Oh, no, just or, in general, man.
In general, yeah. Dire Straits was one of my first loves. And so, you know, for people who probably followed my story, you'd know that was the first musician I ever jammed with was Martin Offler via the Starlight Foundation. So to meet him was just mind-blowing.
If you want to see more of that, you should watch the ABC documentary that Nathan did.
Oh, yeah.
Australian Story, it features that and it's amazing.
And and then I kind of detached from Dire Straits until probably my late 20s. Late 20s is when songwriting from a story point of view, when I was going through my struggles, became important. It wasn't, lyrics were always this afterthought for me. Like if my older bands like Nat Cole and the Kings, sort of, you know, heavy blues rock, it was more about the riffs and the vibe and everything. I'm like, all right, what are we going to write about? All right. And then I'll just kind of write about whatever. But now the song will not get released unless the theme of the lyrics is rock solid for me.
Totally.
Otherwise it doesn't go out. So, Dire Straits, anything Dire Straits. I mean, for me, whether it's Sultans of Swing, I didn't even really, you know, identify with the themes that are there, but I just love the storytelling type lyrics.
So. Right. You get a shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime.
So I love the river, you stop and you hold everything. Martin Offler's biggest influence would have been like, you know, Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Dylan, you know, Don't Think Twice. What a song.
Yeah.
Probably the most overplayed song on Twitch at the moment. Which is okay because it's a great song.
Hey, it's a good time, a good moment to pivot to some of your own music you're putting out at the moment. You're saying like stories and stuff. The other day I showed you a Boho Limousine video.
Yeah, that's an example of that's probably not my most storytelling song. Okay. That's just fun,
give an example. What's a good storytelling song that you got at the moment?
I think Before You Check Out it's a deep one. You know, that message is about how our, you know, the lesson that I learned about how our thoughts colorize our experiences, and when we're not aware of it, it can completely misguide us as to, you know, what our, you know, where our suffering comes from.
Right.
It was written at a time after I lost my he lost his mental health battle, and I remember in the morning after I heard the news, going for a walk, and I thought to myself, God, I obviously wished I would have reached out, and if I did reach out, what would I have said? What have I learned over the years? That could have been helpful.
Yeah.
And this song actually popped into my head within an hour.
Right.
Just that fundamental message of we can literally be walking around in a world that doesn't exist if you are lost in your imagination all the time, which is what us creatives do a lot.
Totally.
We don't even realize it.
You see burn out flames before you check out, before you give in. Just know you're checking out of a place you never been.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, it's a different to come from a place of virtuosity where your career was defined by your dexterity and virtuosity on the guitar to like this kind of, it's a much more soulful expression in a way.
Well, yeah, and I think it's always kind of been a little bit of the debate in the camp, is that there are people that just think I would be more successful if I was to just do the guitar thing like Joe Bonamassa but it's not in my heart. Like it is, but as a part of something bigger, for me, like when I wrote all these songs, I wrote all these songs when I wasn't even intending on releasing or touring. As far as I was concerned, my career as an artist was over because of how mentally broken down I was, but the writing didn't stop. And I was just writing from these deeper places. And, there are bangers on that as well that I wanted to write. But either way, they were all forms of expression. And I was writing music for the first time like I was a kid, where there was no purpose except for just self-expression. It wasn't like, I've got to write a hit for, they're going to play it on Triple J or to get into this market. It was just, I've got an idea. I want to have some fun and just write it, right? Until I'd finished these demos, I'm like, they can't just sit here. I think I've got to put them out and see what happens, and also see whether if I get on the other side of my fears, then make a call as to whether I want to continue, life as a musician. I was actually not going to sing my songs as well. And that's the other struggle that I've had, is that during my early developmental years as a vocalist, I started singing much later when I already had world tours under my belt as a guitarist, and then I'm trying to sing. So people were always comparing my guitar skills with my vocal skills. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine there wasn't much encouraging feedback there. It was just like, you should get somebody else to sing. You should get somebody else to sing. Just play your guitar, do what you're good at. I mean, this is me at 14 years old, at 15 years old, my voice was only breaking. Like, and so that was really hard to shake. So I'd had a serious, was seriously contemplating that when I relaunched as an artist for this album, which was, a couple of years ago, that maybe I should get somebody else to sing it, like what Carlos Santana does. And, there were just too many artist friends of mine, that I respect, people like Diesel and some friend, a mate of mine from Ice House, that was just like, mate, you're nuts. You've got to sing your songs.
Yes, yes. It's a different level of communication when you're doing a gig and you're having that communication with the audience from your voice.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. So it's probably, this last year I've and also just singing and playing on Twitch, like, I'm on there every week. It's I'm just feeling more and more at home with everything that I do.
Yeah.
So Dire Straits is an obvious one. Brothers in Arms, killer, totally. Killer song. Who else? John Mayer, like in terms of modern artists. Something that's a little bit more storytelling would be Stop This Train. I think that's what the song is called, right? Stop This Train, John Mayer.
Let's have a look. John Mayer is another guy I don't know much about. He's kind of like a real guitar god, a modern guitar guy, isn't he? Like, people love him.
Yeah, but I had to be convinced to get into John Mayer because I didn't like Body is a Wonderland and all those early sort of pop songs that he did. They didn't do anything for me. And it wasn't until a couple of friends of mine who always know better said, mate, if you think that John Mayer is a Body is a Wonderland, you're making the wrong call here. Just dive in. And so then I played the album Continuum. And that blew me away. Like the song Vultures and just the production. There's so many things that I love about John Mayer. I love that he is constantly evolving. I love the way that he brings blues roots into the pop world. And he's a great songwriter. He's a great guitarist. And I think I also identify with him because he doesn't have a stereotypical voice that you go, oh yeah, that's a radio voice, or that's he does now because he's created that space for himself. But sure. You know, he's not like, he's got a good voice, you know what I mean? But like, it's not like Jeff Buckley or somebody who's just this amazing.
Well, it's interesting with the voices, yeah, isn't it? Because a great voice doesn't have to be a virtuoso voice, you know what I mean? Like a Bob Dylan. No one's talking about Bob's range or anything, but his voice is like distinctive. And
so I identify with John Mayer in a lot of ways.
Awesome.
Production wise as well, I probably draw a bit on Beck. I love Beck.
Right on.
Yeah. The first album I heard of Beck's was Odelay.
Yeah. Yeah. What an album.
Devil's Heck. And I'm like, what is that?
Totally.
You know, and his production that he's you know, with Danger Mouse. And again, he's another example of somebody who takes these kind of blues country roots and just twists the hell out of them and pushes the boundaries. And that's kind of what I'm about as well.
Totally.
I can get a bit self-indulgent sometimes, but I'm okay with that.
To make good art, you got to be self-indulgent.
Yeah.
Because it's like what you talked about earlier, you got to make stuff that's for you, you know, and that's the thing. Hey, I want to let's wrap this up, Nath. I wanted to ask you a question without notice. I'm sure you've been asked it before. Who's the greatest guitar player of all time?
Oh, damn.
You can give me like a few if you want.
Oh, it's all changed. For me, it's Mark Knopfler.
Right on.
You know, yeah, and I know he doesn't fit into the typical category as virtuoso but for me, when somebody says greatest guitar player or greatest vocalist, it's about who moves me the most.
Sure,
I don't
care how many
notes you play. I don't care whether you can do all these trills and runs and stuff like that. It's like, you know, whether it's one note or two notes, whatever it is, if you move me and Mark Knopfler, there's two guitarists that really, really move me in a big way. It's Mark Knopfler. Now I'm starting to think of more, but it's hard to go past somebody like Angus Young.
Wow.
You know, like I don't even need to say anything about Angus Young. Angus and Malcolm.
They were so good.
Yeah.
I saw AC/DC at Coachella, like in 2014. I was there. And
how was it?
It was wild. So I was DJing every day of both weekends in this little Heineken house thing. And every time I'd get so drunk. It was the bad old days. And I would get incredibly drunk and then stumble out onto the main stage and see who was playing. And one night it was Drake. Another night it was like Sia. They're like these incredible acts on this giant stage with the LEDs. And the production over there is incredible. Everything sounds great. Everything looks great and stuff. And one night AC/DC were headlining. And I was like, oh man, you know, you got to go support the boys. And you go out there. And it was so different because they're not playing to a click. They're not doing... Everything was just raw and swaggering. And you realize how tight everything else had been. All those other acts, everything is pretty pre-produced.
And now you get humans.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it sounded just wild.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I saw them I think it was 2011 or somewhere around there at ANZ Stadium. And I was just, you know, there are some bands that can play stadiums okay. And then there's some bands that were meant to play stadiums. I mean, that's a stadium band.
Yeah.
Like it just sounded amazing. Their energy was just so big. It was, So I reckon, totally. I mean, Angus Young. But Dire Straits, Martin Offler, to me, is it's just amazing.
What are your favourite songs of all time, mate? Have you got a? I generally ask for people's top fives. Do you have any songs that
I've been marinating that, you know? And I'm not. I'm just gonna have to just shout out the ones that pop into my head, or at least the ones that were most influential. So, definitely.
Nathan Cavalieri's top five songs of all time.
Don't say that. You're making more of it. Don't make too much of it. Okay, it'll probably change tomorrow. Stevie Ray Vaughan's Cold Shot. I think that had a ridiculous impact over me. Then we've got, which we already mentioned, Black Hole Sun, Soundgarden.
Yep.
AC/DC, You Shook Me All Night Long.
Oh, so we haven't listened to that one yet. Let's put that on.
No.
AC/DC, You Shook Me All Night Long. Come on, where are we? This is the one I don't listen to that often.
Really?
I should more.
Oh, that chorus is just...
One of my favourite singers, Alana Stone, did a cover of this on Rock Quiz. And I still listen to that.
I mean, the gift to be able to just invent such iconic and catchy riffs without playing too much.
Like, totally. That's it's really straight the minimalism, isn't it? Like,
that's it.
Then the bass comes in. There.
Yeah.
So good.
I've chucked this one in for a laugh, but this was my first ever run-in with dance music.
Good.
Amok.
Oh, I love Amok. 2 Ks? One K. I know this one very well. Well, how did you run into Amok?
The back of some chick's car. And I was just like, this is awesome. I used to get out the glow sticks, go to Sublime.
Yeah. It's all about the breakdown, this song. So I've skipped to the breakdown.
Totally. You know it.
You used to go to Sublime, like on Pitt Street, in a home and things.
Yeah, the Pitt Street one. Yeah.
Hilarious. We were probably there at the same time, man.
Oh, it takes me back.
Oh, it's so, they're all so fast, those late 90s things. And also, in terms of things aging, I do think there's some of that stuff has aged great. Someone could put out that track right now with that riff, and it'd be great because the riff is so good.
Yeah. All that stuff. And remember when it used to go, what was it? Happy Hardcore? Is that what it was called?
Even faster. There was like, here's Johnny and that kind of thing. You know?
Yeah.
Bam, bam, me, bam, 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 bam. I kind of tuned out of that because you couldn't dance to it and the girls weren't into it. So as soon as it got faster, the women would drop out and I lost interest.
No good for anyone. Probably top song, Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms.
Great.
What a tune.
I'm going to fire that up.
I mean, it's a ballad. It's very, very slow.
Mm.
And, it's all interpretive. There are people who are just going to listen to it and go, I don't get it.
It doesn't matter, man. It's you. It's for you. It means the most to you. And also, it has 186 million plays on Spotify, so I think there's a few other people out there who like it.
I think so.
All right. Nathan Cavalieri, thank you so much, man. It's been a delight to chat to you.
Yeah, absolute pleasure, mate. Yeah.
Let's do a gig sometime.
Looking forward to it.
See you, mate. Thanks.
Man, have a good one.
That's it. Thanks so much, Nathan, for taking part. I always love talking to him. He's an amazing guy. I highly recommend you check out his Twitch channel. Just search for Nathan Cavalieri on the platform. It's phenomenal, and it's just such a rare treat to be able to spend so much time with a musician as gifted and a person as lovely as Nathan Cavalieri. If you'd like to message me, I love hearing from you. I love hearing that you're enjoying the podcast. I'm Hot Tub Time Machine on all the socials. If you dug it, tell a friend. I recorded lots of these while I was in quarantine, so there's plenty more episodes coming. Thanks so much. See you guys. Bye.